From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. I love talking about saints on this show, as listeners know. I like talking about these might-be saints, people on the path to sainthood. But I also like talking about the ones who have been officially canonized by the Vatican. So it's those are big-time celebrations when those things come to pass. And it's just this past week was the 700th anniversary of St. Thomas Aquinas' canonization. So that's a big saint and a big big commemoration there. But today we're going to be talking about two saints. And of course, this being the Miracle Hunter Radio Show, I love talking about miracle working saints. And so two feast days that are coming right up, we have Blessed Solanus Casey from Detroit. His feast day is on July 30th. So we'll be talking today with Father Ed Foley. And also we'll be talking about Saint Charbel, that saint from the Middle East whose feast day is on the 24th of this month. And he had an incredible miracle here in the United States. Daphne Gutierrez was miraculously cured of blindness through Saint Charbel. So we'll be excited to hear what she has to say about that incredible miraculous cure. Check out my radio show, or check out my television show on EWTN, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, every Saturday at 5 p.m. Central Time. And next Saturday, we'll be airing the episode on Loreto. The Holy House of Loreto is where the Virgin Mary is believed to have lived and received the Annunciation. But how did it get from Nazareth to its current home in Italy? I'll be investigating that one in a new episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter. And check out next week my episode of They Might Be Saints. We look at the martyrs of La Florida. And so the extraordinary faith of the Spanish priests and Appalachian natives that were killed while evangelizing and defending their Catholic faith in Florida. And we'll be looking at that on the episode of They Might Be Saints. Check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available from EWTNRC.com. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project like we always do. There's a different Marian devotion that lines up every single day to the calendar year. And for July 24th, we've got the Mother of God from Ravesh in Russia from the year 1539. We'll also be looking at the might-be saint of the day, Blessed Manuela de Jesus Arias Espinosa from Mexico. Her feast day is July 22nd. And the question of the week, are the visions of Juliana of Norwich approved by the Catholic Church? It's a tricky one. I'll try to answer that one later in the program. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week, where we look at the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. For people who want to keep up to date with miracles happening each and every day, you can connect to the Facebook feed of the Miracle Hunter Facebook page, and we post items there from miracles happening all around the world each and every day. And this is probably not a miracle. This is just, I'm kind of interested in archaeological finds that relate to Jesus and Mary and the saints. And so in Israel, it was just reported that a 1,400-year-old Christian gravestone was found with an inscription to Blessed Mary. And there was a woman whose tombstone was found during archaeological excavations in Israel, may have lived in Negev during the Byzantine period. And its attempt to clear the national park in southern Israel yielded another archaeological discovery. A team of researchers found a 1,400-year-old tombstone with the name of a Christian citizen engraved on it. And scientists assume that the fragment of the tombstone comes from the Byzantine period. And according to the report published by this journal Haaretz, the inscription on the tombstone reads, "Blessed Mary, who led an immaculate life." It was written in ancient Greek and translated by Dr. Leah de Segni of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And it's assumed that the discovered tombstone comes from the period between the 6th and 7th centuries, and this is just one part of the tombstone. And it's the latest discovery made in this area. This stone, like others discovered there, is believed to have belonged to Christians living in the village of Nizana. And the Smithsonian Magazine points out that Nizana was once the center of many settlements of the area. In the 6th century, it was an important stop on the trade route, as well as a popular resting place for pilgrims heading to Santa Catarina. And so little is known about the settlement, but this is an interesting discovery. You can read the entire article from Elatea if you go to the Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter. Let's take a look at Catholic Club Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer if you think that's the right answer. And last week we were talking about Our Lady of Akita, the weeping and bleeding statue from Japan. So we asked, in what state in the United States was the most recent case of a bishop-approved weeping statue? Bet you didn't know there was one anyway. So it was Hobbs, New Mexico, in 2018, that was reported that this bronze statue of the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of Guadalupe statue at the Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, appropriately, was weeping tears of oil on four different occasions. And so that was a kind of a remarkable thing and featured in the Washington Post. So this week's question, we're talking today about St. Charbel. And so the question is, which Middle Eastern country has the largest Catholic population by percentage? Again, the question is, which Middle Eastern country has the largest Catholic population by percentage? If you think you know that answer, want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email. Go to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and send me a message that way. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father Ed Foley, the vice postulator for the canonization cause of Blessed Solanus Casey. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show or tune into my program on EWTN on Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time know that I love talking about future American saints. And there's perhaps 22 venerables and blesseds on that path to sainthood. People can check out my book as well called They Might Be Saints, available from EWTN Religious Catalog. One of my favorite stories and favorite episodes that we've done, and it actually aired on the feast day of this future saint, is this past July 30th, and that is Blessed Solanus Casey. He's been renowned as a miracle worker, and it's absolutely amazing the number of cases and favors and blessings and potentially miracles that still pour in even to this day. So during life and after his death, we see him as an incredible miracle worker. We're so excited today to talk to one of the people who was involved with the program of They Might Be Saints on the life of Blessed Solanus Casey, one of the key interview subjects, and he is the vice postulator for the canonization cause for Blessed Solanus Casey. Welcome back to the program today, Father Ed Foley.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be with you again.
It's always great to chat with you. And I think people in the United States who are interested in saints and people who need miracles are interested in this person, Solanus Casey. And I think that, as the Miracle Hunter, I always like to keep up to date on the latest and greatest related to sainthood causes. But for people who need to get to know Solanus, let's paint the picture of who was the man.
Solanus was an Irish farm kid, sixth of 16 children, born in Wisconsin, who came from a quite religious family, very tight-knit. He left the farm, as other kids do, to go away and try to make some money and send it back to his folks. Support the family. He did a series of jobs. He was a prison guard at Stillwater Prison and worked a trolley. And he had a traumatic experience when he was still working on these jobs and it decided that he better look at a vocation. And he studied for the priesthood in Milwaukee, at a seminary in Milwaukee, but it didn't, because it was German speaking and he was a little older, it didn't work out very well. It sort of said, you know, maybe look at a religious community, you're a nice guy. So he joined the Capuchins. It was a little rough for him as well because we were a German speaking community and they eventually ordained him, but because they didn't think he had the intellectual capacities that they thought were required, they didn't give him faculty. So he was ordained what is called simplex. They didn't exactly know what to do with him as a ministry, so he answered the door, and he was the porter.
And that turned out to be a big deal for him, as far as that's where he interacted with the people who came there, and he ministered to them and heard their stories. Tell us about the experiences that people have reported over the years having met Solanas at that door.
Right. He originally was opening the door for other people, and as you indicated, he eventually is the reason why people come to the door. And he was a listener, and as you mentioned early on, there were many favor reports that started to occur early on, and so his superiors asked him to begin recording these things, and at his death, there were these seven notebooks with over 6,000 entries. I've actually just finished indexing all of them, and there are multiple miracles that people claimed. Even Solanas occasionally uses that language, or cures, or and some of them are physical. But he also addresses lots of family trauma, family violence, missing people, and of course, this is during the 20s and 30s. There's a lot of financial struggle, people losing their homes, so. He was a source of healing in all sorts of ways for folk, and it included people whose physical healing didn't come about, but he was a source of solace for them. And there's even one of the sections in the index about how often people talk about enabling somebody to get to a happy death. It's his joy. I mean, one of the things stunning about looking through all of his writings is that he comes across. I mean, I can't name a disease that somehow he didn't run across. I mean, it's incredible. And so many children who were sick, and he just brings this Deo gratias, this thanks be to God spirituality. It's most amazing, his resilience and his care. And the other thing that's surprising is that it's not just Roman Catholics. He continuously will say, non-Catholic, Presbyterian, Orthodox, Methodist, Lutheran, Jewish, atheist. I mean, the gamut of people, Baptist, evangelicals. It's quite amazing his ecumenical outreach in his front office ministry.
Amazing. We're talking today with Father Ed Foley, the vice postulator for the canonization cause for Blessed Solanas Casey. And I think one of the remarkable stories that were recounted in the episode we did of They Might Be Saints related to when two sisters approached him, one who needed a healing and got it, and another who needed a healing and didn't get it. I think there's a lot to be taken away from that. What do we, as we reflect back on this moment in Solanas' life, what did that all mean?
Well, I think it's difficult to know exactly what it meant for them, though I think the one sister understood that that suffering and sacrifice is part of the Christian journey. I think what it means for us, especially those of us who follow like a canonization cause or somebody who is a miracle worker, is that that the gift of physical healing is not always God's will, and that's not the only miracle. And as I think one of the people who was interviewed on the program with me indicated, is that she wanted folk to know that sometimes God answers every prayer, but sometimes the answer is no. And just because God says no to what we expect doesn't mean God isn't listening. It means that we're not tuned to the divine will that's calling us beyond maybe our immediate need.
Yeah, amazing. I think there's a lot to be learned from that scene in the life of Blessed Solanas Casey. And as we talk today with Father Ed Foley, the vice postulator for the canonization cause, we talk about miracles that have happened and actually been approved by Rome. One is the healing of Paula Medina Zarate's ichthyosis, a genetic skin condition, which we featured in that program for They Might Be Saints. And looking forward, Father Ed, what needs to happen in order for Blessed Solanas to be recognized now as a saint?
Well, the ordinary path is that another miracle has to be verified. And We're very cautious. We get many, many favor reports. Actually, this year already, we've received over 50 favor reports. And we have medical consultants who look at them. And Rome's basic question is there a medical explanation for this? And if we find something that our medical experts say they're not sure of, we consult with our postulator general. We have Father Carlo, who is in charge of all saint and blessed processes for Capuchins around the world. And he's the one then that signals whether or not there's sufficient evidence that we would move forward. And the moving forward would be, as with Paula's healing, purported healing, but now proven healing, occurred in the Archdiocese of Detroit. So the investigation occurs in the diocese or the archdiocese in which the purported healing takes place. So in that case, and in any future case, our postulator would write to the local bishop and say, we are asking you to please begin this process of gathering a tribunal, doing an investigation, writing up a report, consulting with the medical experts, having independent medical folk brought in, and then returning that to Rome, that goes through the congregation, the medical experts, their recommendation, and eventually it goes to the Pope. And it's the Pope, the one who decides. And it was Pope Francis who, in May of 2017, confirmed the healing of Paula as a miracle.
Amazing. And I think there's great hope here, as you would attest to, that so many people are writing in. Even today, yearly, you get in so many reports of favors received through the intercession of Blessed Solanus Casey. And for people who would like to visit his tomb and perhaps leave a petition there, they have a place where petitions can be left. And of course, people can go and kneel in front of his tomb and pray, as Paula did. What will people experience if they go to the Solanus Center?
We tried to create the Solanus Center not as a shrine, but as a pilgrimage place. And part of the theology of pilgrimage is one of the most important parts of pilgrimage is going home and changing. So it's a beautiful space filled with art and images, and there's a wonderful museum there that has many of his. We have so many of his artifacts and clothes and that you yourself used in the program in EWTN's filming there, a room with his vestments, and eventually moving to the tomb where he's surrounded by this gallery of saints and the corporal and spiritual works of mercy and in beautiful Pawabic tile, and the ability to be right there. And people leave. We started counting the petitions in 2019, and to date we have over 700,000 notes have been left at the tomb. But the hope is that people not only go and leave their petitions that the local community takes up in their daily prayer, but also moves home with the spirit of Solanus, his generosity, he helped found the Capuchin Soup Kitchen, the way he reached out to so many people. His spirit of generosity and welcome and hospitality. So the hope is you go experience this sacred space, but bring the sacrality back in your own spirituality. And even in your own family, because Solanus was intimately related to his sisters and brothers. They corresponded continuously through his life. We just found a huge cache of letters that were sent to him from his brother, Monsignor Edward Casey, who was from the Archdiocese of Minneapolis-St. Paul, was a missionary in the Philippines. He was so close to his family, and the family was a place of spirituality. So, and there's a picture of them all together in the museum. And so going home and taking your own spirituality from Solanus into your family would be in consonant with his spirit.
Wonderful. Well, I encourage people to check out that center if they're in Detroit, but they can also go online as well to solanuscenter.org for more information on the Blessed Solanus Casey Center there in Detroit. It's a great place to visit, and as you mentioned, we were there filming for the EWTN program, They Might Be Saints. Well, thank you so much, Father Ed Foley, for your great work as Vice Postulator on the canonization cause. We look forward to that very next step, which would be sainthood for Solanus Casey. Thank you so much for being with us on our program today.
You're welcome, Michael. Great to be with you again.
God bless. That was Father Ed Foley, Vice Postulator for the canonization cause for Blessed Solanus Casey. Check out that center, solanuscenter.org. I think you can probably submit your own miracle reports there and your prayer petition requests, or go to the center itself for that. And of course, check out that episode of They Might Be Saints on Blessed Solanus Casey. You can go to EWTNRC.com, the EWTN religious catalog, to pick up the DVD for that, or go to ondemand.ewtn.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. I love to hear what people are thinking about related to miracles, so I really welcome your questions. And people have some good ones. And when I give a talk, I travel around the country maybe 20 times a year, speaking at Catholic parishes or shrines or other events, conferences, and I usually give a talk for about 45 minutes, and then I leave it open to questions at the end, and usually those go about 15 minutes, but sometimes they've gone as long as an hour, because people have questions about miracles. I try to have the answers if I can. And for people who want to get me to speak at their shrine or parish or conference, you can connect to me through my website, miraclehunter.com. Just go to the contact tab, and we'll see if I can come out to your parish to give a talk. Many people are asking me these days to talk about Eucharistic miracles in this time of Eucharistic revival. So let's check about the mailbag for the question of the week. Here's the question. Hello, Miracle Hunter. I'm looking for information about Julian of Norwich. I searched your site in various categories, but was unsuccessful. Where do her revelations stand in the church? Any assistance is appreciated. Many thanks, Maureen. Well, thanks, Maureen, for your question. And this is an alleged apparition of the Passion of Jesus. That's what it relates to here. But for people who don't know who Julian of Norwich, or Juliana of Norwich, as some people might call her, she lived from 1343 to 1416, and she was an English anchoress of the Middle Ages. And for those people who don't know that term, anchoress, that's someone who, for religious reasons, withdraws from society to live sort of a prayer-oriented ascetic life. Now, her writings were known as Revelations of Divine Love and are the earliest surviving English language works by a woman, although it's possible that someone anonymously had written some of that. It's the only English surviving works by an anchoress, and she lived in the English city of Norwich. Now, we're talking specifically, or you're asking specifically, about the Revelations of Divine Love. She became seriously ill at the age of 30, and she could have been an anchoress when she fell ill, though it's possible she was just a layperson at the time living at home. So in 1373, she actually received the last rites of the church because it was expected that she was going to die. And she held a crucifix above the foot of her bed, or the priest did. She began to lose her sight and felt physically numb. And she gazed at the crucifix and she saw the figure of Jesus beginning to bleed. And over the next 7 hours, she had a series of 15 visions of Jesus, and a 16th the following night. And on May 13th, this was May 8th when she was expected to die, and she had her visions on May 13th, she completely recovered from her illness. Now, the question is, what do we make of these visions that she experienced, or those that that were written about in that book? And the question is, do we consider these to be approved revelations or visions of Julian of Norwich? So What's interesting about the visions of Julian of Norwich is that they fall in an era that is before the era of investigation in the Catholic Church. So 1545 to 1563 is when the Council of Trent first set up the rules for the investigation of miracles. And prior to that, there was sort of a prayerful discernment that might happen throughout the ages by a local priest or a bishop. Maybe the church community would get together and pray if a miracle was happening. So there was no formal investigation into these visions of Julian of Norwich, and she's not canonized by the Catholic Church. So usually when there's a saint who claims visions, we kind of say, you know, give that the thumbs up, because lying about visions wouldn't really match the life of heroic virtue that a saint is said to have. So when saints claim visions, we usually consider them to be authentic, but she is not a saint. She has not been canonized. She is not in the Roman Martyrology. But what's interesting is that she is quoted in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And so so that's pretty interesting. And Pope Benedict XVI, he discussed the life and teaching of Julian at a general audience on December 1st, 2010, where he said, "Julian of Norwich understood the central message of the spiritual life, God is love. And if one opens themselves to this love totally and with total trust and lets it become God, one's sole guide in life, that all things are transfigured, true peace and true joy found, and one is able to radiate it." And so we have Pope Benedict quoting Julian of Norwich. So that's pretty fascinating. Now, of course, that doesn't make her equivalent to a saint. There are many people who have had good quotes that maybe are even quotable by a pope. That doesn't make her a saint. G.K. Chesterton, for example, is not going to be named a saint, but his quotes are quoted by, or his writings are quoted many times, so by various people. So in the case of Julian of Norwich, here's somebody who obviously is a respected writer to be quoted by the Pope, but she's not canonized, and her visions have never been investigated. Very long-winded answer, Maureen, to say that these visions claimed by Julian of Norwich have never been investigated by the church, have no approval, but somebody who seems to be recognized by the Pope, at least, as somebody with some good aspects to her life and teaching. So, complicated answer, but there you go. If you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and send me a message that way, and answer, and we'll see if we have a question for you to be answered on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. We do this every week, where we look at the Marian devotion of the day. For today's date, we have the Mother of God of Ravesk from Russia in the year 1539. And believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion for each and every day of the calendar year, whether it's a Marian feast day, commemoration of a miracle, the building of a basilica under a Marian title. These are all occasions that we celebrate the Mother of God throughout the year. So this Mother of God of Ravesk, the story goes that Stephen the monk was at a crossroads near Ravesk in northwest Russia on Pentecost Sunday, May 26, 1539, when he discovered in the trees two sacred objects, a large iron cross and an old icon of the Virgin and Child with St. Nicholas of Myra. When a light began to illuminate the trees, many miraculous healings followed. Stephen went to Moscow to give the account to the Metropolitan Joseph, the head of the Russian Church, and he constructed two new churches, one in honor of the cross of Rezhev and the other for the Virgin Mary and St. Nicholas. In January 1571, the holy objects were moved to Moscow at the time of the dedication of these two new churches, and the feast of the Ravesk Mother of God commemorates the return to Ravesk on July 24th. 1409, so on July 24th of that year, so 1541. So fascinating devotion, the Mother of God of Ravesk from Russia in the year 1539. For more information on this devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions throughout the world, check out 365dayswithmary.com. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week, where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood who we say they might be saints, from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue. These are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. Of course, this connects with my television series, which airs weekly on EWTN, and also my book, They Might Be Saints, which is available from EWTN RC. www.sainthood.com. And when we talk about Sainthood News, we always like to give you the updates on people who are coming down the pipe, so to speak. We have those people who are servants of God, venerable, blessed, before they have all their miracles and are declared a saint by Rome. And this past week, we had the 700th anniversary of the canonization of Thomas Aquinas. The Pope released a special letter for this. You can read it on the Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter. But as far as new saints coming down, we have on Thursday, June 22nd, the Pope received in an audience His Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. And during this audience, the Pope authorized the same Dicastery to promulgate a decree regarding the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Maria Diomira del Verbo Incarnato, who was born Maria Allegri, and she's a professed religious of the Congregation of the Established in the Charity of the Good Shepherd. She was born April 26, 1651, in Firenzuola in Italy, and she died on December 17, 1677, in Florence. And according to the website for the Dicastery for the Cause of Saints, it says she was a professed religious of the Congregation of the Established in Charity of the Good Shepherd. She devoted herself intensely to the contemplative life, also enjoying extraordinary mystical phenomena. The victim spirituality that she had embraced made her patiently welcome the sufferings that she offered for the church and for the salvation of souls. And so that is now Venerable Maria Diomira del Verbo Incarnato. And with one miracle, she'll be declared a blessed. A second miracle, she'll be named a saint. Let's take a look at the might-be saint of the day. We do this every week where we talk about those people whose feast days or death anniversaries line up exactly to the day's date. And for today, we have Blessed Manuela de Jesus Arias Espinosa from Mexico. And so she was born on July 7th, 1904, in Ixtlan del Rio in Mexico. And she was the fifth of eight children in her family. And as a nun, she entered the Monastery of the Holy Mary in Los Angeles, California, in 1929. And she made her perpetual vows on December 14th, 1933, and she lived a cloistered life. And she was a founder of the Congregation of the Poor Clare Monastery Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament in Cuernavaca in Morelos in Mexico, and that received papal approval in 1949. And she was the founder of the Missionaries of Christ for the Universal Church. And by the time of her death, she was overseeing 30 missionary houses in 14 countries, and over 6,000 of her writings still survive. And she died on July 22, 1981, in Rome of natural causes, declared venerable in 2009 by Pope Benedict XVI, and she was declared blessed in 2012, also by Pope Benedict XVI. With one more miracle, Blessed Manuela de Jesus Arias Espinosa will be declared a saint. And for more information on They Might Be Saints or any of the programs coming up about They Might Be Saints, like the Martyrs of La Florida, which airs next Thursday, you can go to theymightbesaints.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be hearing about the incredible, miraculous cure of Daphne Gutierrez from blindness through the intercession of Saint Charbel. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who listen to this show know that I love highlighting the stories of miracles, the modern, real-world stories where people have experienced incredible healings. And those don't happen every day, and perhaps that's why we call them miracles, because they are rare. And the Vatican doesn't necessarily investigate every type of miracle that's propped up. When it comes to healing miracles specifically, they look at those cases that relate to canonization causes. And at Lourdes, they look at those cases of people who have bathed in the water of Lourdes. But there are other cases that happen around the world, and some are just so remarkable that we can't help but call them miracles. And we have this incredible story of Daphne Gutierrez, who's a young mother from Arizona, and she completely lost her vision in both eyes due to optic nerve damage. And due to her visit and interaction with the relics of Saint Charbel at a local church, her vision came back to 20/20. We're so excited to be joined today by Daphne Gutierrez and her doctor, Dr. Ann Borick. Welcome to the both of you to the program today.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Well, Daphne, I'll start with you. Talk a little bit about the circumstances where you start to lose your vision in your left eye and your right eye. Talk about what that was like to be the mother of young children and have your vision disappearing.
I had what's it called, pressure in the brain that caused my vision to go away. I had a BP shunt and an LP shunt to drain the fluid. And yeah, you know, just because of the pressure, you know, and the migraines and everything that was going on, that's how I lost my vision. You know, I got to the point where, you know, losing my vision, using a white cane, and, you know, for them to tell my husband that, you know, because he couldn't care for me or my kids, you know, it was best for me to go to a nursing home for them to, you know, to take care of me and all that stuff.
Amazing. And Dr. Ann Borick, you were on the medical team who treated Daphne Gutierrez and her condition of blindness. Dr. Ann, what did you experience with her? What was your judgment as her doctor of her condition when you first learned about it?
So Daphne had a condition, intracranial hypertension. And what happens is the optic nerve basically is irreversibly damaged. And so, you know, when her vision came back, and it was pretty abrupt, when she, you know, after her experience of prayer, confession with the relics of St. Charbel, she went to her ophthalmologist, and within 48 hours, her vision was completely restored. But not only that, the appearance of the optic nerve was completely normalized. And that's something that you just don't see. And this is really a beautiful, powerful testimony to the power of prayer and the intercession of the saints that really do manifest themselves in our lives. You know, it's a rare occasion to see something like this, but really, St. Charbel is one of the most active saints in our church today. You know, honestly, there's like thousands and thousands of miraculous healings, not only physically, but spiritually, emotionally, through the intercession of St. Charbel. But Daphne is one of those ones that you just don't see every day, just like you said.
Absolutely incredible to hear this story. Daphne, talk about what inspired you to perhaps seek the intercession of St. Charbel or to even go to the church with the relics. How did you have that idea in the first place?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was actually my sister-in-law, my husband's sister, the one that took me to St. Joseph's Maronite Catholic Church, because he goes to church, he listens to the radio, you know, and me and my husband had gone to different churches, and they would tell me, hey, go here, you know, and I would go, and I would always say, well, what's the point, you know, I'm not getting healed, you know, he's not listening, God's not listening to me. So, yeah, I was at the point where I'm like, okay, I got to accept this. And my sister-in-law calls me and she says, hey, Daphne, she's all like, I heard that the relics of St. Charbel are going to be here. She said, I'm not asking you if you want to go, I'm going to be taking you. So at that point, it was like, okay, I told her, I remember clearly that once I told her that, once we were there, to tell me when we were in front of the church, just because I just wanted to say, hey, you know what, I'm here. It was my last. For me, it was my last. And I said, you know, if you don't want to do it for me, do it for my kids. I'm here. I remember my sister-in-law telling me, I'm just going to put you where the relics are. And after that, she said that they were doing confession. And she's like, you want to go? And I said, no, I'm okay. And she's all like, no, I'm not asking you if you want to go. I'm taking you. So she did take me to confession. And when they took me back to where I was sitting, I just remember, like, my sister-in-law saying that that she had asked Father Aki to pray for me, and that moment, it was like, okay, somebody was like, I was, you know, somebody was on my other side. Like, you know, if he was on my left, I was feeling something on my right. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I feel something, I felt someone I couldn't explain what I was feeling.
And did you now, were you touching the relics of St. Charbel, or what was your interaction there at the church?
Yeah, when my sister-in-law took me, she did take me to touch the relic, and she said she had me there for a while. So then all my stuff started. I believe that it was after I went to confession, because that's when, you know, she said, "Oh, I'm going to have the priest pray for you." And, you know, when she was telling me afterwards, she was like, "Okay, he was standing on your left and you were feeling something," or I don't know if he was on my left or my right, but I was feeling something, you know. And she's all like, "No, you know, your daughter wasn't there close to you, so it wasn't her, you know, it was only the priest and I standing by you." You know, when I came home that night, you know, because we were there till late, you know, I didn't want to leave. It was that by staying, by praying, by, you know, really, really asking God to help me, not only because of me, but like because of my kids. Now, the next morning, it was Sunday, and they were going to have the relics still there. And my husband said, "Okay, well, I'll take you this time." I remember he did take me. And then he said that there was a lot of people. He said there was a lot of people, and I don't know, that at the same time I was telling my husband, I kind of felt like weird. He said, "What do you mean?" And I'm like, "I don't know. It's just the feeling that I have." You know, he did take me to the relics. You know, he's like, "Okay, it's time to go. We're going to go eat." I'm like, "No, I just want to go home." At that point, I just wanted to come home. I didn't want to go anywhere. You know, I wasn't feeling good. He did bring me home. And I was just tired. I remember I was just tired. I remember when he was putting me to bed, he kept on telling me what was the matter. And I'm like, "I don't know. I just, I don't know." You know, I went to sleep. And what I just remember was that, you know, at the middle of the night, I was telling my husband that my eyes were burning. My eyes were burning, and he's like, no, you know, just go back to sleep. You know, you have no sensation in your eyes. You know, there's nothing going on. And I kept on telling him, "No, you really got to, you know, pay attention. This is what's going on. I'm feeling like burning on my eyes." You know, he did get up, and then I kept on telling him. So then at the point where I'm like, I wasn't seeing, but like I was like shadow, you know, I was able to tell, like, if your eyes were like two little holes, your nose was another hole, you know, type of like that. And he's like, no, you can't. I'm like, yes. And then last he turned on the light, and he said, "I'm going to turn on the light." And then I remember telling him, you know, that all that burning and stuff. And he kept on telling me that it smelled like burned meat, like, you know. And I kept on telling him, "No, it's probably because I was sleeping, you know, my breast stinks, whatever." No, it's not that. So when he turns on the light, I kept on telling him, you know, it's like, I don't see you clearly, but I see, you know, I see those two little holes in your, like, where your eyes supposed to be and stuff like that. And he's all like, no. And I kept on closing and opening my eyes, trying to see if I could see clearly, and I couldn't. It was just like blur, but like black, and you know. So at that point, I just started crying, and because he didn't want to realize that, you know what, he wasn't paying attention pretty much, like what I was telling him. You know, if I was telling him that I was able to see, and he was like, you know, he was like, no, go back to bed, you know. So, and I didn't want to go back to sleep, you know, because if I had it for me, it looked like if I've had the opportunity, like, to, hey, my vision's going to come back, you know, the last thing I wanted to do is go to sleep. So I kept on telling him. You know, until a point where, you know, it was like, he's like, "Okay, go back to sleep." And so I had to, you know, but for me, it was the longest night, because he's all like, like 2-ish, 4-ish o'clock in the morning. And he's all like, and I kept on telling him, "Call the doctor." I at that point where I'm like, okay, I'm not seeing clearly, but I'm you know, I'm seeing something. I wanted him to call the doctors. I wanted to do everything. And he's all like, it's too early. Nothing's open. Wait till later, you know, a couple more hours. And he's all like, just go to sleep. And I said, no. I was just scared that, you know, what if I would have gone to sleep and I wouldn't be able, like, to see? So it was like tossing and turning and I kept on saying, hey, you know, is it time yet? And even though I couldn't see, I had my phone, you know, I could press on it and it would tell me the time, or, you know, I can say, hey, call this person or whatever. So I kept on, you know, hitting the phone and it would tell me, you know, 5 something, 6 o'clock, like, until like, I was like, okay, 7. I was like, okay. And I kept on pushing him. So then we didn't realize that it was Martin Luther King Jr.'s Day. So it was like, okay. So at the morning, I told my husband, hey, you know what? I can see you better, like, you know, not clearly, but, you know. So I told him to call the doctors. We didn't know, like I said, we didn't know it was Martin Luther King. Nothing was open. So they're like, no, we can't bring you in just because the doctor's not here. We can schedule you in for Thursday. And I was like, no, I need an appointment now. I mean, I'm like, now I need a doctor now. And they said no. I called the church and I told them, hey, you know what, I don't know how it happened. I just went and I explained to them that my sister-in-law had took me and my husband had taken me Sunday, and I was like, I don't know what happened, but this is what's really going on. So I went to my eye doctor and he was surprised to see me because he's like, okay, what's the matter? And any changes or whatever. And I told him, I don't know what, you know, what happened. But I did tell him I went to church, and I said I went to church and there were some relics and I'm not seeing clearly, but I can see. No, Daphne, that's impossible. So they checked me, and yeah, I mean, I did cry because he didn't believe me at the point, you know, where I'm telling him I'm able to see. He's all like, no, it's just on your mind. You know, you're wanting to see, you know. And I said, no, you know. So he said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and bring you back within 24 hours and we'll recheck you again. So, yeah, I went back. And now this time I went with no white cane. You know, I was able to go in by myself. Everybody at the clinic was surprised. So when they do the test, he said, Daphne, where did you go? What did they do? What happened? Like, you know, and I said, I already told you. I went to a church and I went to touch some relics. And after, I don't know, a couple hours, you know, something happened and now I have my vision. And he's all like, no, he's all like, well, it's unbelievable because you have a 20/20 vision. With your case, this is not like, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. So yeah, he was surprised of how I got my vision back. It was, for me, it was like, I was heard, you know, but not only was I heard, I think that, you know, it was like, if it weren't for my sister-in-law that took me, I mean, she's actually a stronger believer, like a, I don't know how to say it, but I think she had to do a lot to it. I mean, we didn't know about St. Charles at all. Like, at the moment where she takes me and, you know, I just say, hey, you know what, please help me. I mean, I went to so many different churches, asked so many different ways, and it seemed for me that nobody was hearing me out. And for him to hear me and to be like, okay, I'll ask. It's like, for me, it was like, okay, I'll ask God for you, you know, and, you know, and he heard me, and, you know, thank God, thanks to St. Charbel. Now, you know, I can see my kids every day. I can be with them. I'm so happy to be able to say St. Charbel was the one that heard me, you know, that healed me, you know. He asked God for me, and they both healed me.
Yeah, this is an incredible story. We've been talking today with Daphne Gutierrez, the recipient of a healing from blindness through the intercession of St. Charbel. And we're also joined today by Dr. Ann Borick, who is on the team of doctors that examined her case after her vision was restored. Dr. Ann, when you heard of what happened and you were able to examine the records before and after, was this something completely shocking? Have you ever seen anything like this?
So, you know, as I said, St. Charbel is a very active saint. And yes, I mean, we've heard of many miracles through the intercession of St. Charbel. We know about Lourdes. We know about the power of healing that God manifests in love. But to see somebody who was blind one day and can see the next, honestly, I've never seen that before. I mean, that was, you know, just a really beautiful testimony to the power of prayer. And the other thing that I think was really a lesson for us is that, as Daphne said, you know, she didn't know who St. Charbel was. And so he's a saint for everybody. This isn't just for people who are devout, you know, Catholics, but we hear stories and we know of testimonies that people are touched by the intercession of St. Charbel who are not even Catholic, who are, you know, of different religions. So he really is a saint for everybody. He has the ear of God. Like Daphne said, he asked God and, you know, and the miracle, the healing, the graces were there. The other thing that I often tell my patients and that the lesson for me in this was oftentimes we can be instruments for other people, but we're called to pray for others. And for Daphne, it was her sister-in-law who had, you know, real deep faith that was the instrument that brought her to healing. And so I think that one of the lessons is that we should never stop praying for our family members or for our friends and to be, you know, maybe that instrument that God wants to use, that St. Charbel and the saints use to help manifest their power.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible, the story of her return to 20/20 vision. And when we talk about, from a medical point of view, the restoration of what was damaged, it did, according to your test, your study of this, did her optic nerve, did her disc, whatever it was that was damaged originally, did that completely restore back to normal function?
Completely restored. In fact, we have pictures, and we have a before and after, and it's profound. In fact, you know, when we started investigating this case with Daphne, we took her to three different neuro-ophthalmologists, people that specialize just in this, you know, pseudotumor cerebri, which is called intracranial hypertension. There was no explanation. In fact, one of the physicians asked their partner what the optic disc looked like after the miraculous healing. And there was no way that ophthalmologist believed that was a damaged pathological disc because it was completely normal.
Amazing.
And that's amazing. That just doesn't happen.
Well, so grateful to the two of you, Dr. Ann Borick, your doctor, for joining us, and Daphne Gutierrez, the recipient of this incredible healing of blindness through the intercession of St. Charbel. Thank you so much to the both of you for joining me on today's program.
Yes, thank you
for having me.
God bless. That was Daphne Gutierrez, the recipient of a healing from blindness through the intercession of St. Charbel, and Dr. Ann Borick on the medical team who examined her after her restoration from blindness to complete 20/20 vision. Absolutely amazing. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Daphne Gutierrez, talking about her miraculous cure from blindness through the intercession of St. Charbel. And also Father Ed Foley, talking to us about the great miracle worker, Blessed Solanus Casey. And we're all praying for his canonization. And check out my EWTN television series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tonight, we do an episode on Our Lady of Loretto, the incredible, miraculously transported house, we say, from the Holy Land to Italy. And check out my book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. I'd like to thank you today for joining me on Miracle Hunter. We're from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.